From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, writer Barry Hanna. Truman Capote once called him the maddest writer in the USA. Over the years, Hanna has mellowed, but he's still fascinated by violence and characters that embody evil. His novel, Yonder Stands Your Orphan, is just out in paperback. Also, we remember writer June Jordan with a 1989 interview. She died 1 week ago at the age of 65. Jordan emerged during the Black Arts Movement of the 60s and 70s and continued to write poetry and essays that address social and political issues. Rock historian Ed Ward plays the early productions of the songwriting duo Lieber and Stoller on their short-lived label Spark Records, and film critic John Powers reviews the new Spielberg movie Minority Report. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israeli tank crews and machine gunners killed 4 Palestinians today in the West Bank city of Jenin. The army called the killings a mistake. The Israeli Security Cabinet authorized the army to reoccupy West Bank areas until the terror threat is eradicated. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Palestinians in Jenin said people were shopping for food, believing that the curfew on the city had been temporarily lifted. But Israeli tank crews nearby had no such understanding, and they fired shells and machine guns at the crowd. Among the dead, 3 children, aged 6 to 12. Israeli official Gideon Meir said it shouldn't have happened, and the army regretted the loss of innocent life. He also charged Palestinian bombers and gunmen with hiding among the civilian population. Israeli settlers held an emotional and angry funeral today for 5 settlers from Itamar near Nablus, gunned down in a Palestinian attack last night. After the funeral, Palestinians say settlers ran amok in a nearby village, killing 1 Palestinian and burning buildings. Israeli police are investigating. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The Justice Department is asking the Supreme Court not to allow the news media or the public to be present at hearings for immigrants who've been jailed on suspicion of terrorism. The administration wants to keep the hearings secret, saying that public hearings would allow terrorists to find out what the government knows about them. News organizations and civil liberties groups say that without open hearings, the public can't tell whether the immigrants' rights are being protected. The FBI in West Virginia has arrested a man wanted by police for questioning in connection with the disappearance of a Salt Lake City teenager. Beverly Amsler reports.
26-year-old Brett Michael Edmonds, the focus of a nationwide manhunt, checked himself into a Martinsburg, West Virginia hospital Thursday. Police say he was suffering from a drug overdose. Police from Utah are traveling to West Virginia to interview him and also to search his car, which was found in the hospital parking lot. Salt Lake City Police Chief Rick Dinsey says Edmonds is in the intensive care unit and his physical condition will determine when he'll be questioned. He says Edmonds is not a suspect in the kidnapping of 14-year-old Elizabeth Smart.
He's a question mark, and we want to put a period on that question mark, and that's all it is at this time.
The teen was taken from her bedroom in an affluent Salt Lake City home more than 2 weeks ago. Edmonds' car had been seen in the neighborhood by a milkman just days before the kidnapping. For NPR News, I'm Beverly Amsler in Salt Lake City.
Fire officials are pulling their crews out of the way of 2 wind-driven wildfires in eastern Arizona. They say conditions are too unpredictable to risk firefighters' lives at the front of the fires. Officials fear the 120,000-acre Rodeo fire may merge with a smaller blaze that's now about 8 miles away. In stocks today, the Dow lost 178 points, or nearly 2%. It closed at 9,253 in very heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 23 points to close at 1440. This is NPR News. A federal judge in Kansas City, Kansas, has ordered R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company to pay $15 million in punitive damages to a former smoker who said the company misled him about the dangers of smoking. David Burton had both legs amputated because of a circulatory disease that he blames on smoking. The UN Security Council has approved a very short extension of UN peacekeeping efforts in Bosnia. Linda Fasulo reports from the United Nations.
Security Council members were expected to extend the UN civilian police mission in Bosnia and reauthorize the NATO-led peacekeeping operation for 6 more months. But that all changed when the United States submitted an amendment Wednesday that would exempt peacekeepers from possible international criminal court prosecution. Now, facing a possible U.S. veto, the Council decided to approve a 9-day extension in the hope of resolving the matter. Meanwhile, the U.S. has threatened to withdraw from the peacekeeping operation if participants are not granted immunity. Many council members support the International Tribunal. The United States, however, is opposed, fearing frivolous prosecution of U.S. soldiers and officials. For NPR News, I'm Linda Fasulo at the United Nations.
A federal jury in North Carolina has convicted two brothers on charges that they funneled money from a cigarette smuggling operation to the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah. The jury found 28-year-old Mohammed Hamoud guilty of providing material support to a group that the State Department has designated as terrorist. His 37-year-old brother Chalky Hamoud was convicted of cigarette smuggling, credit card fraud, money laundering, and racketeering. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Saab, presenting the 2002 all-new 9.5 sedan and sport wagon with the power of turbo. Information and dealer locator at saabusa.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is novelist and short story writer Barry Hanna. Larry McMurtry has called him the best fiction writer to appear in the South since Flannery O'Connor. William Styron described Hanna as an original and one of the most consistently exciting writers of the post-Faulkner generation. Hanna writes about the American South. He grew up in Mississippi and has taught for many years at the University of Mississippi. He has won the William Faulkner Prize, been nominated for an American Book Award, and was a National Book Award finalist. His latest novel, Yonder Stands Your Orphan, was just published in paperback. The title borrows a line from the Dylan song, It's All Over Now, Baby Blue. There are orphans and guns in the novel and plenty of evil as a killer changes the lives of everyone around him. Hanna wrote the book while getting chemotherapy treatments for lymphoma. He's now in remission. I spoke with him last year when the book was published in hardcover. We started with a short reading.
This is Man Mortimer, who is the evil that lurks in this book, and he likes to cut people. He comes from Missouri. And there's a little piece about him. At this juncture, he had no plans to hurt people around the lake. He did not like bodies of water much, had never seen the ocean. He was indifferent to trees. Soil was hateful to him, as was the odor of fish. But like many another man, 45 years in age, he wanted his youth back. He wanted to have pals, sports, high school girls. This need had rushed on him lately. He lived in three houses, but he had no home. He did not like the hearth, smells from the kitchen, an old friend for a wife, small talk. It all seemed a vicious closet to him. He moved, he took, he was admired. But he had developed a taste for young and younger flesh. This was thrilling and meant high money. Men and women in this nation were changing, and he intended to charge them for it. Religion had neither formed nor harmed him. Neither had his parents in southern Missouri. But he despised the weakness of the church and of his parents, whom he had gulled. He was a pretty boy born of hawk-nosed people. He was a curse to have these looks and no talent. Long, lank, hooded eyes, sensual lips that sang no tune. Still, he quit the football team because of what it did to his hair, claiming a back ailment that had exempted him from manual labor since age 14. There are thousands of men of this condition, most of them sorry and shiftless, defeated at the start. Many are compulsives and snarling fools, emeritus at 20.
Is this character of Man Mortimer based on anyone?
No, he's not. He's a compound, and I've gotten, just by looking around and believing that I perceived evil in front of me. So it is imaginative, but a collected history of my impressions, I believe.
You describe him as a quiet man, a gambler, a liaison for stolen cars, and a runner of whores, including three Vicksburg housewives. Describe his kind of crime.
His kind of crime is a kind of crime that begins out of laziness and being admired by women. He finds he can make a living at it, and he continues since he ran away from home in high school. He's not been particularly violent, but he has induced violent suicides in others. He is a thief. He has a stolen car ring, especially expensive SUVs. He's a man who doesn't like to work, and he doesn't like much of what's offered by nature. So I feel him as an alien without real pals and only a commercial connection to women. He wants to join in society now, but he only knows how to hurt, and that's the base of the book. Evil, when it reaches out to you and when it befriends you, and in Mortimer's case, he likes to use a knife.
Why did you want to create a character who embodies evil?
I have been fascinated with how evil goes unpunished, even unseen, in this life. And I wanted the evil to work on a group of folks I have already imagined in my short stories around a beautiful lake of my youth. And I thought the evil that Mortimer represented would give each of them decisions to make. And it would give a focus to their lives. So that I suppose I am just interested in evil and what it does to folks in a community.
Has evil like Man Mortimer's kind of evil ever come into your life?
I've been around it. Usually evil is something you can't face. It simply has to wear out. Sometimes you work for evil unwittingly. And I can't think of a particular person right now, but I think I've felt the closeness of evil in casinos. And it brings out the old Baptist in me. I find the wretched excess and the sort of zombified folks that attend and participate in casinos pathetic and also dangerous in many cases.
Now, what about violence? There's some violence in this book. Has violence come into your life? Have you witnessed it? Have you ever had a violent streak yourself?
I like to throw knives back in my drinking days, but no, I've never been personally violent. I can't be an honest man, though, and tell you, but that I am occupied by violence. It seems to be out of my nightmares, and my wife wishes I wouldn't write about violence, but as soon as the pen starts going, I become interested in it all over again, and it's as if it's almost dictated to me, because I've been writing for 35 years, and it's attended a good deal of my work. At this point, I don't think I can do anything but confess that I am a student of violence, because of what it does, because of how it quickens the character of those around it.
Everyone in your book is quite damaged in some way or another. Why is that?
Well, you know, I noticed the New York Times reviewer said that this book was a parade of gargoyles, and there are damaged folks in it. I think that people are needing to mend around a lake. A lake is a great contemplative body for me, and lakes have soothed me all my life. And I think that the wounded and those in despair might naturally gather around such a lake to live. I do not think my characters are particularly grotesque. My honest view of how folks live. And I have those fans of mine who don't really see them as terribly eccentric, or my painting them as obsessive. They think they're looking at life straight on. When you look at all of us, you're going to find a kind of private hurt that can be monstrous, and our private obsessions are very strange to others if they knew them. That's about all.
No, I think you wrote most of this novel after being diagnosed with lymphoma, and some of it while taking chemotherapy treatments. Were you feeling kind of particularly damaged yourself when you were writing, physically damaged?
Yeah, and that probably contributes to the themes of damage in the book. I hadn't considered that, but my wife read the book, and she said, you know, this is very dark. And I had told a buddy of mine, very close to me, Dan Williams, you're going to have fun with this one, Dan. There's a lot of exuberance. And when it was finished, it was darker than I knew. I do think I was writing out of some real obsession with mortality and physical pain and on steroids some of the time. Well, the steroids were my only energy, the only drug that kept me standing during the chemotherapy.
How do you think the exhaustion of being sick and taking chemo affected your will to write, your ability to write, the style that you wrote in?
You know, I really can't answer for that. I know that much came in a rush, private inner rushes, and that it was composed in tranquility that became a little more panicked and more panicked as I wrote, because I got deeper into treatment and into weakness. So it was a book that may be paced beginning with kind of a healthy or just a clinical observations about folks, and then it becomes maybe more frantic.
It takes a lot of endurance to write. I mean, I think it's a pretty exhausting, mentally exhausting occupation, physically not so much so because you're just sitting in a chair. Were you surprised at how much energy it took to write?
Yeah, I've never been this weak in my life, and I was shocked by weakness, which just accompanies the treatment. And I agree it takes a lot of energy and a lot of muscular strength. I mean, I use a pencil, and I love all of these tools, but it never had occurred to me what a vast physical job writing was until this book, because in my earlier books, I had trouble keeping up with my pencil. The stories were coming so hot and heavy. In this one, this was a rather long and very exhausting view into a force that weakened me personally. I had 100 pages more than this book was, and it was cleaned up and helped beautifully by my editor, Amy Hundley, and by my wife also. My wife typed the manuscript. I was, for the first time in my life, very, very dependent on the women around me, and very beholden and full of love for these people.
We're listening to an interview recorded last summer with Barry Hanna when his novel Yonder Stands Your Orphan was published. It's just come out in paperback. He's still in remission from cancer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Barry Hanna. His latest novel is called Yonder Stands Your Orphan. There's a bar in which the novel opens. It's called the Walnut Bar. I want you to describe this bar.
This bar is one of the few surviving. I'm turning the pages now. I'm looking into what it is. It's a roadhouse, really. It's with a little bait. He's the man who still has roaches for bait, which is really unheard of since the 50s almost. But he's a wise man in the ways of fishing. He advises folks on depth and lures and the wind. He's a bard. People, men come there because it has none of the trappings of a woman about it. It has a calendar of a naked bosomy girl on the wall, and it evokes the 50s around the Korean War. So it's where men gather in different places in the South, you know, to be men and to talk manly. And it's a rough place, but it's also kind of a church. The bar is Walnut. As far as I know, it's unnamed. And it also is unlicensed. So the sheriff allows it or disallows it to be open. What it is a mecca for fishermen. And every fisherman I know who's serious about going long distances to fish will know something about a roadhouse like this.
Whereas I know nothing about a roadhouse like this. And I don't know whether it's because I'm a woman or because I'm from the North or because I'm from the city. But, you know, I was reading this and I'm thinking, I've never had the experience of being in a bar like this.
There's no reason why you should, Terry. I wouldn't go in there if I were a woman. There's nothing attractive unless you fish and you just see a sort of rugged charm about the folks. It's pretty pathetic, really, when it's on merits. But he does have good whiskey, which he overcharges for, and he's got tales. He's telling stories about people around the lake. So he is kind of the Homer of the place. And the people are disappointed in him, in fact. He's now got a videotape he's selling behind the counter, which is close to child pornography. And it's the two men that we're introduced to, Robbie and Cecil, are sad that he's joined the modern times. But we find, of course, that Man Mortimer himself is doing local films with orphan girls. It's not an attractive place. There's no reason for anybody to go there except rough and kind of manly fishermen who are trying to get away from everything back at the office or the hardware store or wherever.
You grew up in Mississippi. You still live in Mississippi. What are some of the things you think most separate Southern culture from Northern culture?
Oh, God. They're still relatively unhurried here when you get out of the big urban centers like Nashville and Atlanta, which are very cosmopolitan now. They're very much like a lot of the nation. But there's a world of difference between a football crowd and at a Vandy Ole Miss game and a Penn State crowd. I can tell by experience. There is just a leisure about the culture and a kind of love of jokes and especially old times. People in the South are nostalgic by age 11. And I say that in the book, but it's not a joke. It's looking back even to poverty as a great old time. We have a great yearning for softer, quieter, kinder times. I think we're just afflicted with that Irish look at the past as a comfort and a joy. And we celebrate the past a great deal more than other places.
Did you grow up reading a lot of the literature of the South? Did the fact that you were from the South affect your choices in what to read or the things that you were assigned in school?
I did not read the literature of the South. I only heard the great names spoken, Eudora Welty, William Faulkner, Tennessee Williams. I was not literary a bit, frankly, until I went to high school. I got a high school class and started reading some Keats. And then I think next was Jack London. So I'm a schooled literary man. It wasn't just instantly available in the house.
What was it about Keats that did it for you?
I think it was the Ode on a Grecian Urn, and I had such a good teacher, Mrs. Lois Blackwell, that made that thing come alive, and I could see the joy in language and how somebody could get rapturous over beauty. And also knowing that he died at 26 interested me because I was like 17, and that seemed like a pretty decent lifespan then, you know? And so you just get the move on. You can get your poems in, die at 26 and be famous. So that was actually kind of inviting to the stupid boy in school like me.
Have you ever gone through a real dry period writing where it just wouldn't come and you gave up?
Yes. But I think that's what it's good to teach and have a regular paycheck, because I go for some months without inspiration, and it frightens me. It frightens me deeply. Nobody wants to be out of gas. Nobody wants to repeat himself. So these are frightening times, and I was keeping a journal to try to help myself. I've heard that it helps, but my journal was full of such banal thoughts, I wouldn't dare let anybody read them. I was just like taking out the dog, and it's raining today, and I had no great thoughts unless I was working. And that's the way it's been. I just don't think. My thoughts are very average, ordinary. Until I get among people and language, I think I do have some thoughts then, and there's my real work, my mental life. You just wait out these periods. I think it's good. You know, there are already too many books, and you want to save it until you're ready and you can do your best. And then when those days come, that's just a wonderful feeling, because you I get up at 4 in the morning and full of joy, go into those notebooks, and I just feel like I'm the luckiest man in the world.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
You bet.
Barry Hanna recorded last July when his novel Yonder Stands Your Orphan was first published. It's just come out in paperback. The title refers to a line in this Bob Dylan song. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You must leave now, take what you need, you think will last. But whatever you wish to keep, you better grab it fast. Yonder stands your orphan with his gun, crying like a fire in the sun. Look out, the saints are coming through, and it's all over now, baby blue.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Fish, Blood & Bone by Leslie Forbes, a tale of literary suspense. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward tells us about the brief life of a record label run by the songwriting duo Lieber and Stoller. John Powers reviews the new Spielberg movie Minority Report. And we remember the writer June Jordan with a 1989 interview. She died 1 week ago.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller have written hits for hundreds of artists and produced records for many of them. But even legends have to start somewhere. And today, rock historian Ed Ward has the story of the pair's first big business venture, Spark Records.
Spark Records owes its birth to one of the music business's bigger crooks. Don Robey of Peacock Records put out Hound Dog by Big Mama Thornton, a song written by Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, two L.A. teenagers. It was bad enough the kids had to go with their mothers to sign documents allowing them to collect the royalties, but once they did, Robey wrote them a check, then stopped payment on it, and vanished. The two decided that it was time to own the means of production and started a label with Jerry's dad, Lee, and Lester Sill, a veteran L.A. music biz guy. It was simple. They'd write and produce the records. Finding talent after having a million seller wasn't going to be hard, and so in March 1954, Spark 101 came out, a little ditty by Willie and Ruth.
Farewell, farewell.
The second release was by their secret weapon sax player, Gil Bernal, but it was the third one that did the trick.
On July the 2nd, 1953, I was serving time for armed robbery. At 4 o'clock in the morning, I was sleeping in my cell. I heard a whistle blow. Then I heard somebody yell.
There's a riot going on. There's a riot going on. There's a riot going on. I've been cell block number 9.
The Robins were a bunch of kids Lieber and Stoller knew, but somehow, when they rehearsed this song, which was perfectly tailored to the group's comic tendencies, it didn't work. They got veteran Richard Berry, who was to achieve fame with Louie Louie later on, to come in and talk the verse. Setting a pattern that was to haunt Spark, the record sold brilliantly on the West Coast. The duo weren't daunted, though, and they wrote another classic for the next Spark release.
Treat me like a fool. Treat me mean and cruel. God love me. My faithful heart, tear it all apart, but love me. If you ever go.
Unfortunately, Willie and Ruth's version of this song went nowhere, and it wasn't until later when the two presented it to Elvis that the world would hear it. Like many independent record guys, Lieber and Stoller weren't averse to stuff cut by others if the deal was good, and one day a skinny Mississippian showed up on their doorstep with a reel of tape he'd produced back home. The Spark guys must have known his main gig was for Modern Records, another much larger L.A. label, but maybe this stuff was too weird for Modern.
Now something's going on that I can't sense. My baby leave home. Nobody knows where she went. I hate to do it, but I guess I may. I'm going to do what the hoodoo say. Get some of your hair and boil it in a pot. Take some of your clothes, tie them in a knot. Put them in a snuff can, bury them under the steps. Then you wouldn't want, baby, nobody else. So,
please, please, baby.
Thank you.
The kid was Ike Turner, and the tape was by Eugene Fox, who called himself the Sly Fox. Spark put out all the tracks on the tape, but it appeared Modern was right. Too weird. Again, like many independent producers, they weren't above plagiarizing themselves, but their songwriting often lifted the records above the norm.
Here I sit behind a port wine glass. New car sat and not a drop of gas. Nothing down in 3 years to pay. Sounded like a pretty good deal the other day.
I got a new car.
Since I wrote on that dotted line, I haven't been able to sufficiently dine. Toothpicks and soup ain't much of a meal, and $144 a month ain't much of a deal.
I got a new car.
Big Boy Groves wasn't the Robins, but this is a pretty funny record all the way through. The thing was, the Robins were hot to trot, and they wound up with a lot of Lieber and Stoller's best material. They were willing to rehearse with their producers, and in the end, that's what killed Spark.
Oh, I Smokey Joe's Cafe. Oh, I Smokey Joe's Cafe.
One day while I was eating beans
at Smokey Joe's Cafe,
just sitting digging all the scene
at Smokey Joe's Cafe,
a chick came walking through the door that I had never seen before. At least I never saw her bow
at Smokey Joe's Cafe.
Ooh, and I started shaking when she sat right down next to me. Ooh, her knees were almost touching my...
At least it was success that put an end to the label. Neshwi Erdogan, one of the partners in the most successful R&B label of the moment, Atlantic, heard the Robins' Smokey Joe's Cafe and sent a copy to his brother Ahmet at the home office in New York. This immediately resulted in Atlantic leasing the title and putting it out. Once Lieber and Stoller saw how easily it turned into a national hit, even cracking those hard-to-reach pop charts, they lost no time closing Spark and accepting jobs as house songwriters and producers for Atlantic and moving to New York with some of the Robins, who, being from the West Coast, immediately became the Coasters. So maybe we shouldn't be so hard on Don Robey. By cheating two teenagers, he launched two of the most brilliant careers rock and roll has ever seen.
Writer Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Here's the Robins, recorded in 1955.
Well, I met her in a dance hall in Tennessee.
Come on, let's go.
I smiled at her.
Come on, let's go.
She smiled at me.
Come on,
I said, baby, it would move me.
Come on, let's go.
I could dance with you, she said. Anything that moves your dad is gonna move me.
I said I must be
dreaming. I said I must be dreaming. I said I must be dreaming.
I've never been this good to me.
Oh, 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 oh. Oh, oh, oh,
well, let's jump this old dance.
Coming up, we remember the writer June Jordan with a 1989 interview. She died 1 week ago at the age of 65. This is Fresh Air. We're going to remember the poet, essayist, and teacher, June Jordan. She died 1 week ago after a long bout with breast cancer. She was 65. She first became known during the Black Arts Movement of the late 60s and 70s. She wrote about civil rights and women's issues. Remembering the Harlem riots, which she witnessed in 1964, she wrote, "I resolved not to run on hatred, but instead to use what I loved, words, to fight for the people I loved." Jordan was born in Harlem and raised in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, by parents who were immigrants from Jamaica. She wrote over 24 books and taught at Sarah Lawrence College, Yale, and the University of California at Berkeley. When I spoke with her in 1989, I asked about her first teaching experience in 1967 at a writing workshop where her goal was to encourage African-American children to trust in their own expression.
What I did specifically was to ask them whatever it was that they wanted to say, just to tell me exactly how they wanted to say it, and I would write it down exactly as they said it in the same, you know, identical syntax to the spoken piece they had given to me. And eventually then they began to write themselves without editing themselves, censoring themselves, and trying to make their language over into somebody else's idea of, quote, English, unquote. And all of this had an enormous effect on me in the context of Black English, and the question of the relationship between language and politics per se. It seems to me that what I'm talking about, and other people who are similarly concerned, is the entitlement of each and every one of us to speak in the language that we learn at home, so to speak, our home language, and not to have that in any way denigrated or punished by someone who speaks in another vernacular.
Now, I understand that there was a book that you wrote or edited, I'm actually not sure which, that Black parents tried to ban because they thought it would... Explain what the situation was there.
Yeah,
I only know it's scheduling.
That was in 1970, actually. It was a novel that I wrote called His Own Where. And it's the first novel in American literature, per se, that's written altogether in Black English. I mean, everything, you know, not just the dialogue, but the narration as well. And what happened was the different groups of parents, particularly Black parents in Baltimore and Philadelphia and other places like that, really mobilized to get the book taken off the shelves. They didn't want the book available to their children either in libraries or the regular classroom situation. And I began going around meeting with these different groups of parents. I was just astounded. I thought they would be appalled by the sex. But no, what bothered them was the fact that the book was published, even though, as they would say, even though it was written entirely in Black English, which is the language of the two people I was hoping to present.
Now, the parents were upset because they thought the novel would set a bad example, and they wanted their children to learn standard English so that they could get a better job.
Exactly. And I mean, when I was able to meet with them, they were able to see that I'm not a lunatic or anything like that. My own son at that time was very young as well, and I, you know, I'm somebody who's as concerned as any other parent, any other Black parent or whatever. But the point is that because Black English has been judged symptomatic of verbal and intellectual deficiency, Black kids going into compulsory public school situation in the United States regularly find themselves rejected whenever they open their mouths, and that they're told that the language that they bring to the school is not simply different, but that it's wrong.
Do you feel that you write in different kinds of Englishes?
Oh, absolutely. Quite consciously, I feel I'm multilingual within what's called English. Absolutely. That has a great deal to do with the fact that my father really presented all these different kinds of English to me with equal enthusiasm or equal totalitarian demands attached, you know, that I had to be able to give back to him what would make clear my understanding of Elizabethan English when it was Shakespeare, and also give back to him evidence of my understanding of Paul Ernst Dunbar when it was that.
I'd like to ask you to read a poem now. And
okay.
This is a poem from collected in your book, Naming Our Destiny, which includes both old and new poems. This is the poem that actually ends the book. I want you to read the first part of it, and you could introduce it if you'd like.
Well, last year there was a huge memorial and reconsideration, revaluation of the war in Vietnam that was pulled together in Washington, D.C., and really centered upon the reflections of Vietnam vets. And I was invited to come and read it in that venue, and I decided to write this poem for the occasion, and this is the beginning of that poem called War and Memory. Daddy at the stove or sink, large knife nearby or artfully suspended by his clean hand, handsome even in its menace, slamming the silverware drawer open and shut. The spoons suddenly loud as the yelling at my mother, no, she would say, no, Granville, no, about would he be late? Had she hidden away the Chinese laundry shirts again? Did she think it right that a man in his own house, should serve himself a cup of tea, a plate of food? Perhaps she thought that he should cook the cabbage and the pot roast for himself as well. It sure did seem she wanted him to lose his job because she could not find the keys he could not find. And no, she would attempt to disagree. No, Granville, no. But was he trying to destroy her with his mouth? My mouth? My daddy hunkered down, incredulous and burly now with anger. What you mean, my mouth, you woman, who you talk to in that way? I am master of this castle. Here he'd gesture with a kitchen fork around the sagging clutter, laugh and choke, the rage tears watering his eyes. You know to speak to me like that, you hear, you damn black woman. And my mother, backing up or hunching, smaller than frail bones should easily allow, began to munch on saltine crackers, let the flat crumbs scatter on her full lips and the oilcloth on the table.
The first part of this poem is about how your father beat your mother and you. I was wondering if when you were young you used to write about that and hide what you'd written.
No, I never wrote about it when I was young. meaning, the time this poem refers to, I was about 7 or 8 years of age. The kinds of poetry I was writing was exceedingly patriotic, like Flag Day poems, and other than that, I wrote a lot of poems for money. I would write a lot of love poems for my friends, and I would charge them money depending on the length of the poem that they wanted, you know, it's like that.
That's
I
nice.
Never wrote any breaking up poems. I just wrote poems about why you should go with me, you know, it's like that kind of thing.
I guess your poems in a way served the same job that Hallmark cards do now.
Yeah, they did, actually. But I would custom make. You know, I mean, you had an advantage if you came to me because I would know who the boy was you were talking about.
That's right. Do you remember any of these poems?
No, but I remember all the boys. Actually.
In the poem that you just read, there's a line about how you used to, that when your father became abusive, you'd think about calling the police, but you hated the police.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, well, it was a little complicated. I mean, I didn't know what else to do. In those days, I mean, the concept of child abuse did not exist. You know, I just knew my father was beating the hell out of me. And I wanted some help, and I didn't know what to do. And commonly, you were supposed to call the police if you needed help. But on the other hand, because I lived in Bed-Stuy, and Bedford-Stuyvesant was like the largest black community in the country, the problem was that I also knew that when the police came in general, they didn't help, they hurt. But I did call them anyway, you know, a number of times because I needed somebody to stop my father from beating me.
And what happened when they came?
Well, they never came was the thing. I called, but they never came, and I guess I probably sounded like what I was, a little kid on the phone, and in those days, you weren't taken seriously if you were a little kid. I don't really know that would be so different now. I'm not. Mm-hmm. I wish I could believe it is, but I don't think so. I'm not sure at all that the police would respond in a way that meant that they took the child seriously. I don't believe that.
Mm-hmm. Your father must have been a complicated man. You know, on the one hand, he was having you read Shakespeare, and on the other hand, he was beating you.
Yeah, he was pretty complicated. I mean, I'm really glad that I survived his brutality. That wasn't clear, actually, whether I would or not, but I did, I have. And on the other hand, I think it seems to me that the good things that he was trying to do really have guided my life.
Yeah. Do you ever feel that, excuse me if this is like cheap psychoanalysis, but do you ever feel that anger that was bottled up and you directed at your father has gotten channeled into politics and into writing?
Well, you know, maybe. I wouldn't say that because I didn't bottle it up. My father would hit me, and I was his daughter. I certainly hit back. But what I would say is that my father definitely taught me how to fight, and I know how to fight, and I like doing it.
Fighting for causes.
Oh, yeah, that's what I mean. Absolutely, absolutely.
June Jordan, thank you very much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure.
June Jordan recorded in 1989. She died 1 week ago after a long bout with breast cancer. Coming up, John Powers reviews the new Spielberg movie, Minority Report. This is Fresh Air. Our film critic John Powers has a review of Steven Spielberg's new film, Minority Report, starring Tom Cruise. It's set in the future and is based on a short story by the science fiction writer Philip K. Dick.
The late novelist Philip K. Dick once remarked, "You'd have to kill me and prop me up in the seat of my car with a smile painted on my face to get me to go near Hollywood." I wonder how he'd feel about the new thriller Minority Report, which turns one of his short stories into an extravagantly imagined action film that Steven Spielberg's best and most enjoyable work in years. Although the movie's PR blitz keeps bombarding us with stories about Tom Cruise, whose 40th birthday is being greeted as some sort of cultural watershed, the real story here is the pairing of Spielberg and Dick. For if any two artists embody the archetypal oppositions of our culture, fame versus neglect, riches versus poverty, sunny professionalism versus lunar inspiration, it's the greatest corporate artist who ever lived, and the reigning cult novelist of the last 50 years. Minority Report is set in the Washington, D.C. of 2054, where there hasn't been a murder for years. You see, there's a department of pre-crime, a branch of the police that arrests people for crimes that they haven't yet committed, but that three psychic mutants have determined they're going to. The department's top officer is John Anderton, that's Cruise, who believes in the system run by his boss, played by Max von Sydow, and defends it against a Justice Department upstart who seems to think it's immoral. But Anderton loses his own faith when the psychics suddenly announce that he's going to commit a murder, that he's going to gun down a man he's never even heard of. Suddenly running for his life, he scours the city for proof that the pre-crime machinery isn't infallible. Here, Anderton talks to the man in charge of a huge lab-like prison where convicted pre-criminals are kept in gigantic test-tube-like containers.
I forgot there were so many.
And to think, they'd all be out there killing people if it wasn't for you. Look at them. Look at how peaceful they all seem. But on the inside, busy, busy, busy. Okie pokey. Now that is one bad man.
Okay. So you want just the female prevision?
That's right.
I can't let you take that out of here, Chief. It's against the rules.
Anything else going on in here that's against the rules?
Careful, Chief. You dig up the past, all you get is dirty.
Starting from a superb script by Scott Frank, Minority Report does a terrific job of plunging us into an alternate reality. Spielberg has been around for so long that it's easy to take his huge talent for granted. But here it's everywhere to be seen, in the film's pervasive feeling of dread, in its dollops of offbeat humor, and in its inventive action set pieces. There's a classic that takes place in a car factory. He conjures up a baleful future in which cars roar along vertical freeways attached to high-rises, and beneath the city's glossy surface, an underworld sells black market eyeballs that allow you to avoid ID scanners. Spielberg became the most successful filmmaker of all time through his brilliance at making things vivid. But his artistic limitation is a conventional mind, which may be why he's drawn to Dick, who had a mind so unconventional that it nearly did him in. Churning out cheapy paperbacks and gobbling speed like M&Ms, Dick had a brain bursting with ideas about God, the elusive nature of reality, and the self as the ultimate mirage. If he'd written The Bourne Identity, its poor hero would have never found out who he really is. One of Minority Report's perverse pleasures is its bleak portrait of a future that looks like an eerie extension of present-day America in its domination by corporations, its inescapable invasions of privacy, and most urgently, its idea of a squad of pre-crime fighters devoted to arresting criminals before they've actually done anything. An idea not without its resonance now that we're fighting a war on terror. Still, for all of Minority Report's virtues, you can feel the conflict between the cult novelist's subversive interiority and the Hollywood director's desire for spectacle. Where Dick's work crackles with paranoia and a desire for freedom, Spielberg is ultimately more excited about showing off his futuristic world. The holograms that have replaced home movies, the mechanical spiders that scan eyeballs during ID checks. He finds this stuff cool. In the world, according to Dick, people struggle to transcend shadowy forces they can't ever really escape. In Spielberg's world, they can and do escape. The film's last 20 minutes are a letdown because they soften things and make them routine. They transform a visionary thriller into a whodunit whose happy ending comes complete with a beaming pregnant woman. While Spielberg here is being true to his sensibility, the ending reminds us that what gives this movie its sting is Dick's dark vision. Minority Report is undeniably more fun than the original story, for Spielberg will always report to the majority. But Dick's Minority Reports have the authority of a lonely human voice crying out in our high-tech wilderness. We live in his world now.
John Powers is executive editor and media columnist for LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Anne-Marie Baldonado. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by National Geographic, featuring travel products including guidebooks, maps, magazines, and trips, available in stores nationwide or online at nationalgeographic.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, boxer Leila Ali. She never expected that she'd follow in the footsteps of her father, Muhammad Ali. Also, we talk with actress Cherry Jones. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.